From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. March is Women's History Month, so how about a little music from the fairer sex? If only could, I'd make a deal with God, and I'd get him to swap out the laces. Be running up that road, be running up that... I'll take your part. Oh, when darkness comes, Lord, we are so proud. And the Golden State. We're all about female musicians today. We'll start with an opera singer from Rome, Georgia. Then one of the women you might see at the Stopover Festival in Savannah this weekend. Plus, half of the incredible women from the B-52s talks about her new album. But let's hear from you. Who is the best female musician of all time? From Georgia or not? Is it Aretha Franklin, Joan Jett, Joni Mitchell, Beyonce, maybe? Which female musician do you enjoy the most? Call us at 404-500-9457 and we will tally your votes. You can also tweet us at OSD Talk and we might feature your comment on the air. Georgia singer Jamie Barton is a rising star in the opera world. She's only 35, but her voice has filled concert halls all over the world. Here she is performing a work from the opera Adriana Le Couvreur. That was for the BBC Cardiff Singer of the World competition, and Jamie Barton won. And it's just one of many accolades. In 2015, she nabbed the prestigious Richard Tucker Award. That's a $50,000 prize, sometimes called the Heisman Trophy of Music. But Barton hails from a place that's not often associated with grand opera, Rome, Georgia. I spoke with her back in 2015.
Hi there.
Such a pleasure.
All mine.
Let me take you back to Rome, because I understand, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but Wikipedia says your debut as a singer was at 6 years old in a production of Peter Pan at the elementary school in Rome, singing Tender Shepherd.
It's mostly correct. I was in a talent show with my school, and so my parents put me up on stage. I loved Peter Pan, the Mary Martin version that was done for TV way back. And so they put me on stage in a rocking chair with my teddy bear and in a nightie, and I sang Tender Shepherd.
Do you still know that song?
I still love that song. In fact, I use another song from the same musical, Never Neverland, as encores quite a bit for recitals now.
And you know, your background in musical theater, which continued all through your young years, is what people often point to in your singing now, because one of the things that people say distinguishes you is your sense of drama, your ability to really throw yourself in the role and make it a dramatic experience, as opposed to just planting your feet and opening up your lungs and belting it out.
Well, I think that's my job. You know, my job is as a storyteller, and part of the arsenal of tools I have is to be an actress.
You know, that view of being both an actress and a singer, though, is not universal. We've had huge stars, and since she's passed away, I can point to Joan Sutherland, for example, with a gorgeous, gorgeous tone, but everyone talked about her mushy diction, so you couldn't understand what she was saying, and really just not a great actress.
You know, I think times have changed, though. This was, of course, what they call the golden era of singing, with Marilyn Horne and Joan Sutherland and
Maria Callas and
Pavarotti. I mean, like, these people made our art form amazing in their time, and they did it in the way that was comfortable for them and for the audiences. But, you know, we're in a different world now. We're in a world where, you know, if I have tickets to go to the opera, I have a choice of if I actually go to the opera or if I just sit on my couch and watch Netflix. If I'm going to be going to the opera, it is an escapist art. I want to be entertained. I want to be able to lose myself in the 2, 3, or 5 hours as I was just
if it's
in.
Wagner.
Wagner. But, you know, I want to be able to lose myself within that time. And I think audiences nowadays, they can sniff it out if you're telling the truth or not.
Now, one of the reasons we reached out to you to begin with, not only because you've been winning all these accolades and you're from Georgia, is because your name was actually mentioned in an interview we did with Cheryl Milnes, who is obviously legendary baritone. We asked him about who his favorite Georgia artists were, and he said this.
Jamie Barton is a mezzo-soprano, a young mezzo-soprano, whose career has really taken off. She just won Singer of the World competition in Cardiff. I heard her sing at this event, which was honoring my birthday. You know, birthdays are movable feasts, so my birthday is all year long. And, well, she wowed the audience at this event in Manhattan at the Harmony Club. This is going to be a world career. Everyone's going to know her. And she is very proud of being from Georgia.
I'm about to cry. I'm blushing.
But I mean, I can't even imagine what it's like to hear somebody like Cheryl Milnes talking about you like that.
You know, I remember before I had ever been to the Met, before I really was completely into opera, I remember going into Barnes & Noble and finding a calendar from the Met, and it had all these pictures of different opera stars in their different roles, and there was a picture of Cheryl Milnes in Fanciulla del West, and he was just sitting there looking just completely villainous and wonderful, and just in that one picture, I was like, I want to hear that. I want to see that. And so I, you know, sought out the recording. And I've been such a fan of his for as long as I've been a fan of opera. And to get to work with him and Maria, his wife, to have been able to sing to honor his birthday, 80th birthday. Oh, my gosh.
I know.
It's what a compliment.
But let's talk about the very last thing he said about very proud of being from Georgia. I mean, I would imagine that there is some stigma or stereotypes attached to, maybe I should put it this way. Are people surprised?
About the only thing they're surprised about is the fact that my accent has gone away for the most part. Yeah, they can't really place where I'm from. But minus that, no, I think it's funny. There's a lot of opera singers from not very typical walks of life. I know so many opera singers who come from farms. I know of one that was basically, you know, he was picking corn when the Met called. You know, I mean, like that kind of thing. Like, I think this art comes from a very humble place. You know, it's you're singing. That's an instrument within yourself. And so many of us start in church or in choirs or stuff like that. And I think it's communities like the ones that I found in Georgia that really inspire people to do things with their voice. And sometimes it turns into opera.
I wanted to explore this idea of the young singer that you were and how that training began. And let me explain why I say this. You were quoted in the Associated Press as talking about playing the waiting game right now. And the reason people say that is that some of the bigger roles, especially would they be Wagner is a really good example, or even to go into things, some of the heavier Verdi roles, aren't suitable for a 33-year-old voice. Why is that?
Absolutely. Technically speaking, as women, our voices are still shifting and growing and shifting and growing and shifting and growing until we're about upper mid-30s. So to start in on the bigger roles before your voice has kind of calcified is actually technically, physically a difficult and dangerous thing to do. You can train yourself into bad muscle memory, that sort of thing. Also, in my mind, I want a little more life experience. These ladies that you're singing, they're extraordinary. So I'm inching my way towards them, and I'm taking my time. Opera is a long game. It's a marathon. It's not a sprint. And so I get the luxury of deciding I want to wait until this time in my life to sing this role or that role. And I'm lucky enough with things like Cardiff and the Richard Tucker Award to be able to work with companies to pick and choose when I can do them.
So then help me explain, or maybe you can address this issue of the young phenomenon. We'll often see these 8-year-olds singing operatic arias, and you're laughing, but it's true. And I always get afraid that people are going to see things like that and then stick their young 8-year-old into heavy voice training at too young of an age. Help me be an informational source to explain why you would or would not do that.
Kids can sound amazing. They're almost made of elastic, I think, as any parent would know. You put them on a bike, they fall off, they bounce back. However, vocally, I've seen so many people who started out with natural talent and started voice lessons too early and end up destroying their voice in the process. Kids of you know, both genders, all ages, they, from the age of 0 all the way up to 18, think of how tall they grow. That's just the height. So this, everything that's within their throat is changing massively. And if you try to train a voice that young, you're putting literally too much pressure on it. I always have heard, and I stick to the rule if I'm ever teaching people, which I unfortunately don't get to do very much these days, and I love doing, but if I'm ever teaching people, I don't teach kids who are younger than, say, 15 or 16. It's about then that it would be okay to start getting into it. But, you know, I took piano for years. I did choir, both in church and in school, and getting knowledge of music through piano, which is fantastic, through choir, which you get to sing, but you're not hurting your voice. These are wonderful ways. Choir is a free way to be able to train yourself musically and to train your kids musically. So I'm a big proponent of putting your kids into that kind of musical experience, but wait until later for the voice lessons.
I wanted to talk about your voice in particular because it is a big voice.
Yes.
Now, while you are waiting to sing the Aidas, right, you're doing a lot of songs. And as a musician myself, I kind of sit back in wonder because this has to be not easy. This is a clip of you performing Gretchen am Spinnrad, but this is a Schubert art song. And this was at the Aspen Music Festival. So a few of those of you out here have never heard that piece before. I highly recommend it. What you're hearing in the background is the sound of the spinning wheel, Gretchen at the spinning wheel. But to bring a voice like yours into an art song, how do you accomplish that? I mean, what kind of, I mean, you know what I'm asking, right?
I
mean, that's
a
big voice that you're bringing down to the recital format.
You know, I was really lucky in my progression. Like I said, I started in choirs and musical theater. And then I went to Shorter College in Rome, Georgia, and they didn't have an opera program. They didn't have a symphony to be able to play things. We started with recitals and with concerts. So that's really the basis of my training grounds. That's what I've been doing since minute one when I stepped into college and started taking voice.
Such a pleasure to speak with Jamie Barton. She is, as you heard, originally from Rome, Georgia, the winner of the BBC Cardiff Singer of the World competition and the winner of the Richard Tucker Award as well. Such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Coming up, Cindy Wilson of the B-52s talks about making her first solo album. But first, Julian Baker brings her sad and lovely songs to Stopover. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. In honor of Women's History Month, we are focused on female musicians today. So let's listen back to a conversation with an artist who will appear at the Stopover Festival in Savannah this weekend. Songwriter Julian Baker is a Tennessee native. She's only 21 years old, but she's already been featured on NPR Music with a Tiny Desk concert and gotten a write-up in the New York Times. She released her debut album, Sprained Ankle, in 2015.
You think that there's a way, could it ever get too far? You'd ask me where I'd been, like I ask you where you are.
And I spoke to her last year when she was preparing to play at another Georgia music festival, Shaky Knees.
Hi, Celeste. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks for asking. You know, from the outside, this all feels really sudden, like this meteoric rise. I wonder if that is what it feels like for you.
Well, somewhat like that. Yeah, it's been quite the surprising turn of events, like the end of last year and through this year. It's interesting. I just played a show with Forrester back here in Memphis, and having that duality.
That's the band that you played with before you made the solo album.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah. And so, like, still performing with them, you know, it's awesome to get to come back home and play local shows and then play out on tours and stuff. I'm really excited for Shaking Knees. I've never been. It's quite a big honor for me to be able to do things like that.
I wonder what that transition has been like for you performing these solo songs live. And I ask that because they are so personal, at least listening to them, and gut-wrenching in many, many ways. And I wonder what that's like when you're standing in front of a crowd of, I guess, what's the largest crowd you've been in? At least hundreds? Thousands?
Oh, no, not thousands that I know of. I think I would be quite mortified if I had to perform in front of thousands of people.
You would be mortified?
Oh, yes, ma'am. I think it's a God's cosmic joke for a performer to have performance anxiety, but I think it's also, it affords me lots of lessons in humility and transparency, you know? So, I used to get embarrassed. The first tour I ever did on this record before it was released on a label, I was touring with my friend Ryan Azada, who's also a wonderful local Memphis musician, and we were performing just in these little basements in front of 20, 30 kids, and I would start to get apprehensive and think, perhaps I'm exposing too much of myself, or I'm being too open in a way that might upset or unsettle the audience. But then there's always these moments, and it's continued to happen after shows, especially on this last tour, getting to talk to showgoers and attendees after the performance and hearing about their stories and hearing them relate whatever they got out of the song, you know, whatever the song meant to them. And it motivates me that even though sometimes it's uncomfortable for me on stage to feel like divulging that very intimate part of yourself, you do establish a bond with the people you're performing for. And that's something very precious to me, you know, to be able to share that with people. You make these sad songs, but it doesn't mean you're a sad person. Sometimes you make art that's sad or angry, and it allows you to exercise those emotions in a way that allows you to be well-adjusted and a goofball. And, you know, I can be happy and goofy on stage, and it's all right.
So I wonder, you know, the piano on Go Home, it's slightly out of tune, like it's this loose, jangly tuning, and it fits so perfectly. I wonder if that was a happy accident. Was that just how the piano sounded?
Oh, yes, ma'am. I think so. When we recorded it at Space Bomb, we just recorded at the piano that was available there. But I kind of like it sounding like that, it not being overly produced or perfected.
What is that we're hearing at the very end? Is that a TV?
When we were recording the piano arrangement of the hymn at the end, I heard this like crackly like noise coming over my headphones from the control room.
It was like interference in your headphones?
Yes, ma'am. And so what was happening, I was like, what is that? And I came into the control room and we played it back, and one of the vocal preamps for the mic had been picking up a local church radio station, and it was this televangelist speaking on the radio. And I thought, like, oh, wow, what a serendipitous event to have happened while I'm playing this hymn on piano. And so we left it in there as just kind of a strange, out-of-the-blue production phenomenon. I liked it. I liked the novelty of it.
So the song Rejoice, which I've heard you describe, or I read you describe it as your mission statement, that struck me as almost incongruous, because you'd never expect it from a songwriter who starts, I mean, the song for which your album takes its name begins with, you know, that you wish you could write about something other than death. but Rejoice is your mission statement. Why?
So the song is really about being grateful, even for the things that appear to be misfortunes. I was thinking a lot about that, of how whether we understand the formative events in our life, whether they be negative and traumatic or whether they be positive and obviously beneficial to us, they shape us nonetheless. And we should be grateful for all of those things which befall us, because it's like, yeah, I had perhaps some negative or undesirable experiences in my life, but you can choose what to do with that. You can choose to make it into art that establishes a bond between you and another person. You can choose to share that. You can choose to learn from that and make yourself better. So I struggle a little bit with anxiety. And there's a particular passage that I love in Philippians. It talks about rejoicing, and no matter your circumstance, and bringing all of your worries and letting them go. Because even though sometimes it feels like there's no reason to continue, you know, soldiering on, and what we could say is the existential bleakness of life, the futility of trying to be good in a world that is inherently self-defeating, there's still a reason. There's still hope and a motivation.
When your songs are so personal, I wonder what it's like to perform them months and maybe eventually years and years later. Do you think you'd be tempted to change them?
I've been tempted to change them, but I think the reason why I try to preserve them is because even if I've changed my mind about what the songs say, like, for instance, there's a song, Good News, and, you know, now I think all the time, ah, why did I write a song where I'm just screaming that I ruin everything I do? That's not true, and I don't want other people to sing along because they're singing about thinking that they ruin everything. But at the same time, I can't deny that that was a real and valid emotion that I felt at one time in my life. And though I may not feel that way right now, maybe there's another person that currently feels like they're the only person that ruins everything, and their life is a comedy of errors. And if they could relate to that song, then it's worth being honest that sometimes you feel that way. And then you have the capacity to move on if you accept it and confront it. But yeah, there's certain things. I think I was at the Bowery. Perhaps intentionally, and I just didn't realize it. We chose not to say, in rejoice, I think there's a God, but said, rather, I know there's a God. Because it felt like the certainty was really evident in that moment, that singing along with everyone, I was aware of something larger than myself, and I chose to be more certain. You know, so there's little things where how dramatically I change the songs, it might vary, you know, from time to time.
That was Julian Baker, who joined us ahead of her Shaky Knees performance last spring.
I know you're sleeping by now. I'm still up walking around. Walls of my skull been backwards in like a labyrinth. Knew I was wasting my time, keep myself awake at night. 'Cause whenever I close my eyes, I'm chasing your tail lights in the dark.
Also last year, we were in Athens for AthFest, and we brought an Atlanta singer with us.
Red-headed lover on the run. No one knows. Trade me in black.
That's Cy Elaine Spence. She has a distinctive voice and a unique songwriting style. Cy Elaine Spence added a couple tunes to our Georgia playlist. The rules for the playlist are very simple. The songs have to come from a Georgia artist, and musicians cannot choose their own stuff. So here are Cy Elaine Spence's picks.
My name is Cy Elaine Spence, and I'm a singer-songwriter, and I'm based in Atlanta, Georgia.
I'm trying to tell you something about my life. Maybe give me insight between black and white.
The first song I chose is Closer to Fine by Indigo Girls. Well, there's been times where I actually listen to this song on repeat just to hear the lyrics, and definitely I think it's one of those songs for me that just lifts your spirits up whenever you when you need a little bit of a boost.
And lightness has a call that's hard to hear. And I wrap my fear around me like a blanket.
My favorite lyric of the song is, "The best thing that you've done for me is help me to take my life less seriously. It's only life anyway." And when I hear that lyric, I actually think of my daughter because it definitely speaks to that one person or one thing in your life that helps you to just enjoy the moment and enjoy just existing.
And the best thing you ever done for me is to help me take my life less seriously. It's only life after all. Yeah.
I do get some of my inspiration from Indigo Girls. I think mainly because they're female songwriters. For some reason, I like to connect with the stories of women, and I really appreciate when I come across really strong songwriting that come from women. The second song that I'd like to choose is Hearing Blue by Little Tybee. Little Tybee is a band out of Savannah, I believe, and they're actually one of my favorite bands out of Georgia. They're like a mini orchestra, really, and I've seen them live quite a few times. And one thing I like about Little Tybee is that every time you go to see them live, it is like a different show every time. The instrumentation in their music is just impeccable. The song I chose from Little Tybee is called Hearing Blue. I'll go ahead and sing a little bit. Tell me a story, the one we used to know, how the loyal sons betrayed their father's show. That lyric is actually the beginning of the song, and I just love how it opens up. The song is really, it opens up really big.
Tell me that story, the one we used to know, where the loyal sons betrayed their father.
It rides out for a little bit, which is really nice. It feels like a spring day, and I usually play this song while I'm driving in my car on the highway, and then the lyrics come in and the melody is just so smooth.
Made it look easy.
Say that Little Tybee and Indigo Girls do have very distinct sounds that are somewhat unique to one another, and I think for me it was one of those things coming across these types of bands in Georgia. It really helped me to appreciate the myriad of styles that are coming out of Georgia and wanting to be a part of that myself. In terms of having a sound for the state, I would say that before coming to Georgia, I thought that there was this sound across the board. You know, you had Atlanta, the rap scene, and then you have some level of R&B, and I had no clue that there was so much more. So at this point, kind of becoming immersed in the music scene here, I would say that there's so many distinctive styles at this point now, especially, that I can't really say that there's one sound coming out of Georgia, and I think that's a wonderful thing, and I'm lucky to actually be a part of that.
Coming up, one iconic Georgia band was fronted by two incredible female singers. We talked to Cindy Wilson. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. Musician Cindy Wilson is a bona fide Georgia legend. She was born and raised in Athens, and she's co-founder of the band, the B-52s. It's been 8 years since the release of the B-52s' last album, but Cindy Wilson has been busy. She's on tour with songs from a forthcoming solo album called Change. She talked to me last year about her new album and life as a solo artist.
Hi, Celeste. How you doing?
I mean, I have to assume a lot of people are asking you why finally the solo album. I mean, because Kate also eventually, finally,
you know,
both of you.
Well, you know, I think these days baby boomers, musicians are picking up the guitars and keep on being creative. It's really important to do that, you know. Keep doing it. Just don't retire. And by the way, the B-52s are we're going to have our 40th.
Tour.
Yeah, we're still touring. And this will be our 40th anniversary coming
Holy
up
cow.
This coming year, 2017. And we're still playing. We're doing different types of gigs, like symphony gigs with different city symphonies, and we're going to Australia and New Zealand, you know, so we keep on keeping on. And so everybody has side projects, and this is my little solo side project, and it's we've had the best time writing and working with these people, you know.
Is it a matter of time management, because you have been very successful actually at both keeping the B-52s going all these years, but also taking the time out when you needed for raising a family yeah. and having a balanced life. Do you end up now the kids are older?
Oh yes, they're now 17 and 20.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's amazing, you know. I can't believe where the time's gone, you know. But you know, they're great kids, and you know, and I was lucky to be able to be in a cool band that you know, they, you know, understood, you know,
they
left
you
the door
and
open,
come back when you needed.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of times, especially back in the day, that didn't happen, you know. So, but you know, it's kind of a democratic band, and everybody's pretty cool.
So let's actually hear some of the new material. This is, again, right now there's an EP available. The album is called Change,
mm-hmm.
and this song is called Sunrise.
Yes.
So this is a really different sound from
it's
the B-52s.
Departure.
Yeah, it's like you have a different
I'm not
vocal
no
tone.
Burger. Yeah, yeah, it's a departure.
More like a psychedelic, smooth.
Yeah, very, very. Yeah, very smooth and quiet and kind of. It's a lot of fun. I've been playing around and getting a different style. And Suni Lyons and Ryan Monahan and Lemuel Hayes and Marie Devon. We've gotten the show together, and it sounds and it flows. It's just like this, but it doesn't stop after every song. It's like some kind of theater piece, and it's really been interesting.
And you have like a video component that looks almost like a kaleidoscope.
Right. Yes, and it keeps a mixed media thing going, and it's very kind of arty, and I really enjoy it doing it, you know.
How different was it? I mean, after playing with one band for so long, how difficult was it to then get new habits and hear new styles coming from a whole different band?
Well, I love it. This, you know, being the B-52s, we did get to be creative and do different types of things. But this is a totally different. And yeah. It's wonderful because, I'm blessed that the B-52s, you know, are having a long career and makes people happy. And that's really wonderful. But this is a great thing to be able to come in and conjure up new feelings and new, just new creative muscles, you know. So I'm really loving it. And we're getting a lot of good feedback, too.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Miss Cindy Wilson, of course, of the B-52s, but she is currently on tour with songs from her forthcoming album, Change. Are you going to be touring with this at the same time that you have tour dates for the B-52s?
Oh, you know, well, we're doing it. Well, the way the B-52s are touring these days, we're doing clusters of gigs. It's not like one long tour.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's how we keep, you know, the B-52s going and everybody working is like working clusters a couple of times a month and keeping it going, you know. And we have, thank goodness that we can do that. And the phone keeps ringing for the B-52s.
So, oh, I'm sure.
So that's great. And it's a new way of doing it. So you can have a life. You don't have to just constantly be on tour. You know, you do like three shows and go back home. And
well, let me ask about that life, because look, here's the thing. Mm-hmm. First of all, very few bands could last 40 years without getting in arguments and breaking up.
Oh, well, you know, it's in a group of people, you get a group of people, you know, it's going to be like that.
Right, especially if you're on a tour bus together.
Yes, it starts stinking on the bus. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, it's fun. You know, there's everybody's a genius and everybody's a devil, you know. I love everybody. But you're right. It's very hard to keep your space, you know, and continue on. But we've done it, you know, and it's because of how cool everybody is, you know.
You were the major part of all the writing for the B-52s.
Yeah, we write together. But it's different songs are different approaches to it. We've even had friends like write for us, like lyrics, you know.
Yeah.
So we shake it up. But for the most part, a typical way to do it would, and like Funplex, when we wrote Funplex, which was our last record that we did, it took us so long because how we work, you know, like Keith Strickland brought music in, and Kate, Fred, and I would jam like for like half a day on this music, and then we have to sift through all that and see what direction we're going in, and it's kind of interesting because trying to make a cohesive song out of kind of multiple views, you know, and it's kind of interesting. It's like somebody writes one part of the story, another person writes another, and you know, that's how we get the vocal melodies and the harmonies, you know, and you never know what's going to turn up, you know. So it's
that's
been
odd. I didn't think of the B-52s as a jam band, but you were saying that you kind of
in
wrote
the studio
by jamming, yeah. And then, I mean, there's the iconic, that legendary story of the way that you guys first got started, which you were sitting in a Chinese restaurant called Hunan and drinking flaming volcanoes.
Yes, that was our first inspiration. I mean, I met Fred and Kate at a Halloween before that, but we went out to eat. It was Ricky, Keith, Kate, and Fred, and I, and another friend. And we we didn't have much money, so we went to a Chinese restaurant and we bought this flaming volcano drink.
Which is a huge drink where they literally
rum.
Light
Very
it on
strong
fire.
Rum, by the way. And with the Sterno on top, and so it's like a really cool, you know, it's, you know, fiery and everything. And everybody had a straw, you know, and there was a moat around it, you know, so everybody was drinking. And, And, you know, we were just cutting up and having a good time. So we ended up going back to our friend's house in their basement and picking up instruments.
Do you know what time it was at that point?
It was fairly early. We stayed down there in the basement and jammed for a long time.
And wrote some songs.
Yeah. In fact, Rock Lobster was part of it, a germ of an idea, I believe. Fred was a poet, and his play on words are really fun, you know. It's amazing. So he had all these, like, amazing imagery of a party in the ocean. And Kate and I would make sounds and everything and kind of background girl, you know, vocals and everything, and just kind of have fun with it. And then we decided, well, we have to play a party. This is just too funny, you know. And so we ended up playing a friend's Valentine's party, you know, in Athens, you know, which I met my future husband there, and that's the first place the B-52s ever played.
Do you remember how much you got paid?
We didn't get paid.
Oh, you didn't?
No, it wasn't anything like that. And everybody was dancing. It was so much fun, you know.
So what was your first paid gig?
Well, you pay to play at the beginning, and we went up to CBGB's up in New York, and Max's Kansas City, I think, was the first, and then Hurrah's, and that was when we had released a independent single, yeah. And that got around, and we looked out the window right after soundcheck, and there was a line around the block, and then that's when we knew that something was starting to happen for us, the B-52s, and then after that, we got signed, you know, and it was pretty exciting stuff, you know.
So you stayed in Athens. You stayed at, well, you still have a house in Athens, but you decided to stay in Georgia. In fact, I read in one.
No, that's not what happened. What happened was we all moved to New York.
Yeah.
Upstate New York.
And came back.
Yeah, we lived up there for about 12 years. My husband and I did. Uh-huh. And we lived in Putnam County, Lake Mayapack, and then we moved down to the city and lived there and in the West Village, which was wonderful. And I get to go back a lot, but
yeah.
And then after my brother passed, I was really want to kind of connect. The B-52s did Cosmic Thing. We wrote Cosmic Thing, and we toured for that for 2 or 3 years. And after that, I kind of had a hankering to come back to Georgia and kind of reconnect to family, you know, which...
And you described yourself in one interview. We're going to hear a little bit more of the music, the new music in a moment. But you described yourself in one interview as just a regular Dunwoody housewife.
No, I'm not a regular Dunwoody housewife. No.
They quoted you that way, and I thought, well, that's
cool.
Weird.
Yeah, Dunwoody's cool, you know. It's actually a very, very a healthy, you know, people run there and jog, and it's, you know, it's really pleasant, you know. My kids were raised there, so I'm very fond of that, you know, for Dunwoody.
Well, let's hear a little bit more of the music. This is a song called Brother. Baseline sounds almost B-52X, but then you have the breathy sound of the voice, which we're not used to hearing from you.
Yeah.
How long did it take for you to sort of develop the new aesthetic?
Well, that's interesting. We worked on just coming up with a sound, you know, for the new sound for me and the music. So the whole album has this sound, which is great. And we worked on that for a few months, you know, getting the right thing that we wanted, you know. And it took us about 2 years to, working off and on it, you know, to really come with full album's worth. And it's amazing, you know. I love it. I love it. And it's so much fun to do.
And it is a very different style. I mean, the fashion and hair for the B-52s was a major part of what that band is and was.
The freedom to be a freak, you know. Fly your freak flag or whatever, you know. Yeah, we loved the whole aesthetic of just being, you know, have fun and just, you know, just bring it to the stage, you know.
So how does that change? Does that aesthetic really different for your solo album and your new band?
Oh, it's the same thing, really. It's, you know, I'm me, but, you know, I tried to imagine myself being some kind of psychedelic chanteuse, you know. So it's fun.
So is this a first of many?
A first of many what?
Solo albums?
Oh, well, you know, I'm keep on keeping on. You be creative. And I love everybody I'm working with. So it's fabulous. Yeah.
So we have about a minute left, and I'm just wondering about Athens itself. You have a house there still, right?
Actually, I just bought a little bitty place in Five Points. You know, it's got only one bathroom. I mean, I can clean this house myself, you know. And it's great. It's a, you know, so I have like family there, and I'm constantly
still a good
coming
music
back.
Town?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's creative town. It's artists, musicians. It's amazing, the vibe there, and such nice, such down to earth people. Really nice. I love it. You know, it's very nice to come hang out there.
That is musician Cindy Wilson, of course, of the B-52. She's currently on tour with songs from her forthcoming album, Change. The EP before that is called Sunrise, and we'll get the full solo album later. We're going to go out on the song Take My Time. Cindy, thank you so much.
You're sweet. Thank you.
Cindy Wilson performs at Venkman's in Atlanta this Friday at 9:30. And that's our show for today. We're taking your votes for best female musician of all time. Gladys Knight, Whitney Houston, Barbara Streisand, maybe? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us. The show is at OST Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day. Just about to plan. Do you